Hello, and welcome to the Rooted in Reliability podcast, your plant performance podcast, where we dive deeper into asset management techniques and know-how. I'm your host, James Kovacic, and I will be your guide to achieving industry best practice. The Rooted in Reliability podcast is here to provide you with the insights to improve plant performance and deliver bottom-line results to your organization. In case you missed the last episode, you can find the Rooted in Reliability podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and on the reliability.fm network. Don't forget to subscribe so you'll never miss an episode. Now let's dive into today's topic. It's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Richard Overman to the podcast. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you, James. How are you today?
I'm doing quite well. Thank you so much. Now, Richard, you are an author. You've authored the book, Reliability Centered Asset Management, which I have sitting on my desk here in front of me. You know, you're also the managing director of Core Principles. You know, and prior to that, you spent a lot of time in maintenance, reliability, and a variety of other aspects. Can you provide us, you know, fill in the blanks on your history of how you got into maintenance and reliability, what you've done before Core Principles, what you do at Core Principles, all those things?
Sure, James. Thank you. I started in the maintenance and reliability business back in 1985 when I finished up my mechanical engineering degree. And I went to work at the Naval Aviation Depot in Jacksonville, Florida, and began doing RCM analysis on military aircraft, and worked with the Navy, helped to develop the Navy's reliability-centered maintenance process, and eventually went on to represent the Navy for the Society of Automotive Engineers when they developed the commercial RCM standard SAEJA 1011 and 1012. About 12 years after I started working for the Navy, I decided it was time to go over to the consulting side when I was offered a position to work with John Mowbray, the author of RCM2. A lot of people know him. And then spent a couple years working for him, and then spent seven or eight years working with a consulting company that did consulting for the Navy, Wiley Technologies. And a couple of years with Allied Reliability before starting Core Principles. As at Core Principles, I'm basically a one-employee company and do most of my work as subcontract to the other consulting companies if they have some work they either don't want to hire somebody for or just need to augment their staff, then they call me in to help them out. So I've been with that, I've been able to get involved in a lot of things like criticality analysis and more detailed ferry modes and effects analysis, supply chain management, and things like that. So I had a pretty well-rounded experience base.
Excellent. And, you know, I also mentioned, you know, and I think you mentioned it as well, you authored the book Reliability-Centered Asset Management. Now, what is reliability-centered asset management, and how does that differ from regular asset management or reliability-centered maintenance?
Yeah, so when I wrote the book, Reliability-Centered Asset Management, I decided to take the principles of reliability-centered maintenance and apply them to the entire life cycle of the asset. So the principles of reliability-centered maintenance being that we define the function or what we really want this asset to do, how does it fail to do it, what are the effects when it fails or the consequences, and then what do we need to do to either prevent the failure or mitigate the consequences of the failure. So those are basically the principles of reliability-centered maintenance. And I thought, well, how can we apply these to the entire life cycle of the asset? So in the book, I take an asset life cycle of concept. You know, what do we need? What do we want this thing to do from a conceptual perspective? And how does that apply with unreliability throughout the entire life cycle? So I give an example in there where a company wants to build a plant and they think this plant needs to produce 10 million units of whatever it is per year. Well, in order for the plant to be able to do that, they need to build a plant assuming some unreliability at different stages of the life cycle, they need to build a plant maybe that can produce 15 million units per year because you're going to lose reliability. So in the concept stage, I think what a lot of people do is they say, well, we need 10 million units per year. So we build a plant that can produce 10 million units per year capacity. And then they never can because they don't take into account unreliability. So that's taking a reliability-centered approach to the concept phase. And I carry that philosophy throughout the rest of the phases of physical assets, but also personnel aspects. And so if you think about the life cycle of somebody's job, well, the concept phase would be the needs analysis. And the design phase may be the position description and so forth. And so you could actually, in the book, apply these same concepts to somebody's job or other assets like policies and procedures. There's a life cycle to those, and you could do a reliability center maintenance on those. So the book takes a more all-encompassing look at the reliability-centered concepts rather than just maintenance.
All right. Excellent. And, you know, like you mentioned, you define how we apply these principles to each stage in the life cycle. And one of the questions that, you know, if was covered in the book, but I get often is, how did we actually define the level of reliability required for that plant or organization? You know, you use the example of we need 10 million widgets a year. So we build a plant with 15. How do we know 15 is right? How do we know it's not 12 or 20 or what the case may be? How do we define that level?
Yeah, so we need to start out with making some reliability goals. So each step in the life cycle is going to have some unreliability related to it. So you'll never get a design that's going to be 100% reliable. So you have to start out with setting reliability goals for that design. Maybe you want the design to be 90% reliable. Well, if you want 10 million units per year, then just to account for the design unreliability, the plant would need to be able to produce 11 million units per year if you have a 90% reliability. Or, yeah, 90% reliability.
All right.
So we
take into account what that design spec is of, say, 90%, and then we say, okay, if we're only 90%, we have to upsize for that remaining 10% somehow, so we have to build additional capacity for this much.
Correct. And then you do that, you carry that same idea for every step in the life cycle. So if during installation, you're never going to get a 100% reliable installation, so you have to set reliability goals for that, and then set reliability goals for commissioning, for operations, for maintenance, and so forth. And then all those reliability goals are cumulative, and then you can calculate based on those goals what the size of the plant needs to be. But then you need to put in policies and procedures and everything in order to achieve those goals.
All right. So it's not just the conceptual phase. We apply this unreliability calculation and upsizing for it. It's all the different phases. So the concept, the design, the installation, the operate, maintain, and so on and so forth. We have to consider the unreliability in each one of those steps, and it builds on each other.
That's correct. Yes.
All right. Excellent. Now, why do we really need to focus on that design and concept stage? Most organizations seem to just focus on the O&M stage or operation and maintenance stage, and they do quite well. Why do we got to go back and do all this extra work?
Well, a lot of organizations, the reason they do quite well is because they by nature build in excess capacity, or they do debottlenecking procedures or things like that to try to get more out of the plant, or in some cases they have to actually go in and do design changes in order to add capacity to the plant because they realize that they can never produce. But if you take all that into account up front, then you can identify what needs to be done. Depending on what study you look at, the total life cycle cost of a plant or a facility is decided during the design phase. 70 to 90% of the total life cycle cost is decided during the design phase. So if you can take into account all of these unreliabilities in the design phase, then you're way ahead of the curve.
All right. So we do it so we can reduce the total life cycle costs by investing upfront in design for reliability, design for maintainability, those sorts of things.
That's correct.
All right. Excellent. Now, you know, we mentioned the concept phase, the design phase, the O&M phase. What other phases of the life cycle do we have to consider unreliability and apply these principles to?
I think one of the biggest phases, other than design, O&M, and maintenance, that we have problems with is construction or installation. Many companies that do installation don't necessarily do precision installation, where they're balancing equipment, rotating equipment, or making sure of alignment. And things like that, making sure we don't have pipe strain on the pipes, and that all of the electrical units are properly installed to prevent water intrusion and so forth. And so all these things contribute to the unreliability of the plant. So if we had a perfectly installed plant, then the installation phase should not contribute to the unreliability of the plant, but we can never get that. So we need to set goals of how much unreliability created by the installation phase are we willing to accept.
All right. So we have to, you know, set those standards, set those procedures, set that benchmark of what level of unreliability we're willing to accept. Is it 5% at this phase of life, 10%, and make sure we have the mechanisms in place to get there.
Correct. And if you go to a design build engineering firm, for example, and you say, well, okay, we want 90% reliable design, and we only want to lose 10% reliability during installation, they may say, yeah, okay, we can do that. But then if you go and you say, well, we really want 95% reliable design, and we want to lose no more than 3% reliability due to installation, they'll say, yeah, we can do that, but it's going to cost you more money. Well, the mistake that we make a lot of times is we look at the initial cost and not the life cycle cost. But even if it costs you an extra, say, $2 million up front to get the design more reliable and the installation more reliable, that can save you tens of millions of dollars and the overall life cycle cost. So we need to do that balance between how much reliability are we able to get and what it costs, but use a life cycle cost number to understand the full impact of that increased reliability. And usually it's more cost effective to pay the money up front than it is to live with the life cycle cost, because you allowed less reliability.
Yes, absolutely. They look at that upfront price, not the long-term cost. And as a result, we lose that reliability. This podcast is brought to you by Iridicio. Be sure to check out iridicio.com for a free copy of their ebook, A Smarter Way of Preventative Maintenance. This ebook will allow you to review your current maintenance program and eliminate the non-value-added work you're doing, which is most likely causing you more downtime than it is preventing. www.iridicio.com. Now, it sounds like, you know, a lot of the stuff needs to be based on processes and procedures. How important is that in reliability-centered asset management?
Well, the processes and the procedures are important, but more importantly is ensuring application of the processes and procedures. So, for example, you may have a process that says we want to do 100% laser alignment of rotating equipment, and they need to be within a certain tolerance. Well, that process does nothing for you if you don't actually make sure that the people who are doing the installation or the maintenance apply that process and apply it correctly. So the processes provide the cookbook, if you will, of what we want to do, but they're only as good as the extent to which we enforce them.
Absolutely. So with that, how do people fit into this reliable process? Is it the enforcement of those procedures and policies? Is it making sure they're trained? How do they fit into this reliable operation?
Well, it's those, but it's also accountability. One of the things that that I looked at with regard to like person or human assets and applying reliability-centered concepts to human assets would be like in somebody's job description. For example, let's say in our concept, we said we'll only allow or we're going to budget for 10% maximum unreliability during the maintenance phase. Well, then what we should do is our maintenance manager's job description should be to manage the maintenance such that we have no more than 10% unreliability due to maintenance. Most of the time, a maintenance manager's job description might be, well, to keep the plant running or to manage the maintenance department or something like that. But if we build reliability goals into these job descriptions, then we can hold people accountable to those goals.
Yes, absolutely. You know, we set those goals, we hold them accountable, we do all that, and it drives the reliability we need within the system, because that's, to me, where we lose a lot of the O&M reliability is the lack of adherence to processes, procedures, that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's correct. And it's the same with the operations manager's job description. If we say we're going to allow no more than 5% unreliability due to operations, then we build that into the operations manager's job description. And then it's their job to ensure that the policies and procedures are adhered to in order to make that goal happen.
Absolutely. And, you know, when I read the book, you talked about, and you mentioned earlier too, the life cycle of our people. And it's not as simple as hire someone, they do their job, and that's it, right? It might be that way for, I think in your book, you had 3 or 4 different levels of maturity of employee life cycle. What is that most mature version of employee life cycle? Because I think that's how we get those reliable processes and those reliable systems, is we manage the life cycle of our people, same way we manage with the rigor we manage our assets.
Yeah, that's correct. So in the book, I do a table where I equate the life cycle of a human asset to the life cycle of an equipment asset. So like I said before, the concept phase would be the needs analysis, and then the design phase would be the development of the job description, and then installation would be the hiring process. So if you do a poor job in the hiring process and you don't get the right people, then you're not going to be able to achieve the goals that you established in the concept phase or the needs analysis. And then the installation would be the hiring process. The commissioning would be the onboarding process. How well do you bring those people in? How much of a mentorship do you give them? Do you just bring them in and say, here's the coffee pot, go to work? Or do you try to acclimate them to the way you do business? So that would be similar to the commissioning. And then the maintenance phase is analogous to ongoing training. You maintain their ability to do their job by providing them with training or training of new concepts or refresher training and so forth. The operations phase then would be them actually doing their job. And then the disposal phase would be what you're going to do once that person leaves the job, whether it's because they quit, they fired, they're no longer available or whatever. But what kind of a process are you going to use to refill that position once it's vacated?
All right. So a very rigorous process, but that's how we get the right people in positions. We eliminate more of that unreliability. So if we do that well and we have the right people in place, how do we go ahead and implement reliability-centered asset management? Is it a project? Is it a, you know, flavor of the day? How do we do this to be successful?
It's a philosophy. The manager, whatever asset you're managing, whoever's doing the management, they need to learn to think in a reliability-centered concept. And as I said before, the reliability-centered concept is, what do we really want this thing to do? How can it fail to do it? What are the consequences or effects when it fails to do it? And what can we do to mitigate or prevent the failure from occurring? So if we learn to think in that way as a philosophy, then it becomes more and more easy to better manage assets. So for example, this podcast, you have, when you do the podcast, you have some concept of what you want to accomplish with the podcast. Well, then you might look at, well, how can the podcast fail? Well, maybe there's a technical glitch, or maybe the interviewee is not prepared, or the interviewer is not prepared. Those would be failure modes of the podcast. And then how can we prevent those failure modes from occurring? Well, we send out questions beforehand, you know, and things like that. So it's just an overall thought process that a good reliability-centered asset manager learns to use.
All right. Excellent. So it's that thought process. It's the cultural beliefs and that thought process that allows us to do this. Now, one of the things I see with organizations is, you know, they get all excited about this. They go do, you know, reliability-centered asset management, or they start implementing it, and they don't sustain it after that big project or that big push is done. What can organizations do different to sustain it after that initial excitement or the initial project gets completed?
Yeah, so it has to be a cultural change. I've seen companies that somebody comes in, they hire a reliability manager, and this is a very good manager, very high energy, and is a good champion and really moves the ball, the reliability ball, forward. But then that person leaves and the energy gets taken out of it. And what I've noticed over the years is, you have to keep putting energy into a reliability program. If you remove the energy, it will revert back to its natural state, which is reactive maintenance. And so the way you put the energy in there is, you not only have a champion that can put the energy in, but the whole organization needs to make a paradigm shift to thinking in that reliability concept that we just discussed, so that when the maintenance guy goes out to replace a pump, his thought process is, I'm not replacing a pump, I'm replacing a function. And so I need to make sure that function will occur when the operator is making his rounds and he's looking for deviations from the norm. He's understanding that he's not looking for deviations from the norm, he's looking for potential failure conditions. And this whole thought process throughout the whole organization will then provide that inherent energy to keep it going.
All right, excellent. Now, for those that are looking to implement reliability-centered asset management, what would you tell those as watchouts or concerns or things that may trip them up when they're first getting started?
I think the biggest thing is to recognize that it's not a project. It's not just a matter of implementing a process. If they go into it thinking, oh, we're going to implement an RCM or a reliability-centered asset management program, then it will not be as successful as it could be. If they go into it thinking that we're going to change the culture of the organization to one that thinks in terms of reliability-centered concepts, then it will have more of a chance of success.
Absolutely. I think, you know, not thinking about it as a project, but a new way of doing business, a new cultural change. I think that is very, very important. And a lot of organizations, they think of it as a project. Oh, this will be done in a year or two. And then that's why it doesn't always sustain. So I think that's excellent words of wisdom. Now, we've talked a lot about reliability-centered asset management. What is the one action you want our listeners to take away from the conversation today? The one thing they can go do different tomorrow, next week? What's that thing?
You mean other than buy the book? No, I'm kidding. actually, that was only half kidding, because the it's something that they need to make a paradigm shift in themselves. So if it's not buying my book, buy or learn or do research or study into what a reliability centered thought process is like, and then learn that thought process, get comfortable with that thought process, and then use that thought process.
Yeah, I think great words of wisdom, you know, and half jokingly, you're 100% right. You know, get the book, learn about that thought process. How do we apply this to all the different phases of our assets, and start making those minor changes?
Yeah, let me tell you a quick story, if I can, on one of the things I mentioned in the book. When I was writing this book, and I was using an example of a receptionist for the human part of it, and we put a receptionist at the door of the company to create a positive first impression and to greet people who come in the door. And as my wife was reviewing it, she said, "Are you sure you want to use a receptionist?" And I said, "Yeah, I think so." Well, while I'm writing the book, I had a heart attack, a small heart attack, and we went to an urgent care center. We walked in there, and I just started to tell the lady at the door my symptoms, and the phone rang, and she just picked up the phone and answered it. Spent 10 minutes talking to somebody about a billing issue, and I'm standing there having a heart attack. And so I look at my wife and I said, "This is what I'm talking about in my book." So it's, again, it's just that thought process.
Yes, absolutely. You know, that thought process is so important. You know, how do we design out unreliability? How do these things fail? How do we prevent these things from failing? And it's not always just PMs. You know, it might be redesigns. It might be procedures, processes. There's a variety of different ways we can do it. But just thinking that way moves that needle dramatically.
That's right. Everything we do, we have a reason for doing it. And a thought process simply is, why am I doing this? What do I want to get out of it? How can it fail to occur? And what can I do to prevent that failure from occurring?
Absolutely. Now, Richard, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk to us today about reliability-centered asset management. But before you go, where can people find out more about you? Where can they get in touch with you? Where can they pick up the book? All those great things.
Well, thank you, James, for the opportunity and the time. My email is rich@coreprinciples, coreprinciples.com. And the book is available on Amazon.com. And my website is www.coreprinciplesllc.com.
All right. Excellent. I will make sure to put links to those in the show notes so people can easily just click them, get in touch with you, learn more about the book and all those great things. Now, one of the things I always like asking my guests is, what is your favorite resource for learning more about the stuff we've talked about, whether it's the cultural piece, the reliability center maintenance piece, you know, what's your favorite resource?
Well, my favorite resource has been conferences and workshops and things like that. I know, you know, you're probably looking for like a book or something. I think I seem to get a lot out of conferences, talking to people, SMRP conferences. I think a book that I would recommend, there's actually a couple of them. One of them is Ramesh Gulati's book on reliability, maintenance best practices. And then my mind just went blank on the other one, but there's no substitute for going out and meeting other people in the industry. We can get all the books and read them we want to, but until we go out and talk with people and compare notes and learn from their experiences, we don't get as much out of it.
Yeah, I have to agree. Conferences are a great way to learn, not just from the speakers, but also from the other attendees. You know, talking to them, they've probably experienced some of the same issues you have. They may have solved it in a different way that someone else has. You know, going out and creating that connection and having those conversations goes a long way.
Yeah, that's true. There's nothing new under the sun, and all the problems that we experience at our plants, other people experience. There's the solutions are the same. It's just like, you know, people say, well, my plant is special. Well, in some ways it is, but it still uses pumps and compressors and everything else that we all use. And so the problems are the same, the solutions are the same, and we can learn from each other a lot.
Absolutely. Well, Richard, I want to thank you again for taking the time today to talk to us.
Thank you, James.
It's been a pleasure having you on.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
I would like to thank you for listening and remind you that you can always find out more on maintenance, reliability, and asset management at www.iridicio.com and by following our blog. The Rooted in Reliability podcast is a proud member of the reliability.fm network. I'd like to ask you to please rate and review this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. It ensures the podcast stays relevant and is easy to find by like-minded professionals. It is only with your ratings and reviews that the Rooted in Reliability podcast can continue to grow. I thank you for providing this small but critical support. We'll see you next week when we dive into another burning topic with Rooted in Reliability, your plant performance podcast.